You know, the second part of my title is all right. It's in English, The Swing of the Pendulum. But the first part is in Sanskrit. And Sanskrit, of course, is the language in which the Vedas and the Upanishads and many other sacred writings of ancient Egypt were recorded. Now, they were written on palm leaf manuscripts. I've seen in India, I saw many of these. And they are rewritten every 200, 300, or 400 years so that they are preserved, and they are rewritten absolutely identically with the original, so that we have these records of the ancient writings of India today. And of course, this wisdom of the East is creating interest in the Western world, and teachers are coming, teachers from India and other Eastern countries are coming into the Western world to deliver their message, just as in the days of old, ironically as it was, the Christian missionaries went into the Eastern countries. So we are fairly familiar with Sanskrit words. In this town we have a prana restaurant, and in some towns there are Dharma bookshops. So I'm not going to apologize for the word karma or the use of the word karma in my title. Most of you, I'm sure, have some knowledge of its meaning. And Sanskrit words themselves have a quality of depth. And that quality of depth helps a Western person to dig down into the full meaning of the word, which is what I'm going to try to do in my lecture tonight. Now, karma means action, and action implies reaction. This is the great cycle of cause and effect. And the cause produces an effect, and that effect produces more causes. And so there is a continuity in that cycle of cause and effect. In Christian terminology, it has been put this way: whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. But we must be careful not to accept what can be an oversimplified concept of karma. In the first place, no one cause has one effect only. Life is much too complex for that. Have you seen people playing billiards? There is a white ball and a red ball, and the cue hits the white ball, and the red ball and the white ball hits the red ball, and it goes in a certain direction. And the man striking the white ball can work out what way in which that red ball is going to travel when it's hit. But in snooker, there's a panel of, I think it's 15 balls in a triangle. And to open the game, the player hits that triangle, a solid phalanx of red balls, and breaks them. And he, not even the most experienced player, could have any real knowledge of where each of those red balls is going to travel to. So this is the same case in karma. We cannot relate one cause to one effect. The thing is more complicated. And the next point I want to make is that the action, which is karma, includes all physical action, all emotional action, which usually springs from desire, and all mental action, which is thought. In fact, it includes all the activity of the human personality. And if we think carefully into this subject, we will realize that thought, feeling, and you remember that our Vice President, Joy Mills, called this flinking. Feeling, thinking is flinking to her, a very interesting expression. Thought, feeling precedes all important physical action. Not automatic everyday action, but if we have to do something important of a physical nature, go somewhere, do something, then we think about it and we make our decisions on thought and feeling and then we carry them out. So in producing a reaction from a karmic point of view, and just one moment. So the thought-feeling aspect is much more powerful in its effect from a karmic point of view than mere physical action. Now, in producing a reaction, karma adjusts towards a balance or an equilibrium. And this process is like a pendulum, which when acted upon swings out of equilibrium and then back through the equilibrium point in an opposite and almost equal reaction. Shall we try it and hope it swings correctly? And you will see that it's swinging backwards and forwards to about the same point, gradually getting less. Now left to itself, this pendulum will in time stop swinging and will come to a point of equilibrium or balance. But we nearly always, in our actions, or reactions, physical, emotional, or mental, give impetus to the return swing, and the pendulum cannot regain equilibrium. So now I'll do it again. There it is swinging and gradually slowing down. But when it comes back to this point, we push it and it swings further. And this is the process that goes on and on. Instead of coming to a point like that, even when it's swinging quite slowly, we push it further and the pendulum keeps swinging. Now I'll let and hope it comes to the point of balance. So we live in the grip of this pendulum action, a continuing process of action and reaction. But the truth of the matter is that we need not live this way. Action which is karma-less and does not create reaction can and must be achieved by all of us before liberation is attained. And this is why the study of karma is so important to those who are interested in living a useful life from the ethical point of view. Now, if we accept the idea of reincarnation, that there is an individuality in each of us which goes back to the world and is born as a man, time and time again, in a long series of lives. Then for each man, this process of a reaction and this process of action and reaction becomes a great continuum spread over all of those lives. We see then our personalities as the product of the past and realize that we, here and now, are making lifestyles and characters which will be ours in the future. We are making our future now. And this is why the Buddhists consider karma as the moral kernel of any being which alone survives between incarnations. To some of you, this may seem a funny idea, but it does mean that the Buddhist, who was very, very careful in his way of putting these ideas, realizes that that which we do know to carry over life after life is not the personality which changes, but is that which is unworked out action. If you like to call it unfinished business. And that we take with us, or we pick up again when we come back to existence in this world. And that is why a full understanding of the law of karma is required by every disciple before he can tread the path of spiritual illumination. And again, this is the reason why the divine wisdom from which theosophy comes has always portrayed man as master of his own destiny. Each man is his own absolute lawgiver, the dispenser of glory or gloom to himself, the decreer of his life, his reward, and his punishment. And this is true because with an understanding of karma, it is within our power to change our whole outlook and our whole way of living. But to do this, to be able to do this, we must understand that karma is a great impersonal law. Perhaps we could consider, as an example, the law of gravity, which is that, of course, which makes the pendulum swing. It's swinging under the law of gravity. Let us take an example of what happens when this impersonal law operates. If there is a dam built to provide water for a small town up on a hillside above a valley, and it breaks, the water under the law of gravity rushes down the hillside until it reaches the flat land below. And there it spreads out and flows where the ground is lowest until it reaches a watercourse. If its flow is blocked, it turns in another direction. A blockage of debris can protect one farmhouse while another is flooded, and a valuable crop is ruined while adjacent pastureland nearby is untouched because it is a few inches higher up. The reaction or the action of that water is taking place according to law. It is always flowing where it finds there is an opening, where the land is lowest. And nothing alters that fact. So in the same way, the law of karma works. The adjustment of action and reaction in human life must also take place according to law, not gravity, but karma. In the life of every man, that which is misfortune or suffering and is sometimes mistakenly called bad karma is the working out of the law. And in the overall picture, this working out is according to absolute justice. There is, in the overall picture, going back many lives, many lives ahead, in that whole majestic sweep of the existence of the individual, there is perfect justice in the way in which the law treats him and that which befalls him. So from this point of view, there is no good or bad karma. There is only karma. In karmic adjustment, important results are often brought about by utilizing minor personality characteristics and preferences. Something very insignificant can tip the balance towards action which is very significant. A woman misses a flight on an airliner which subsequently crashes because she was moved to stay behind to look after her pet dog which was ill. She gave up her flight for the pet dog, and that little thing saved her life on the airliner. Or, to take another example, a man who is reluctant to attend a musical function notices that his favorite composer, Bach, is on the program and decides to go. And he meets someone there of immense importance in his future life. Perhaps he married her. Anyway, these little things have lasting and very important repercussions. Many of you will have had this type of experience and have been aware of the subtle control over our lives exerted by the karmic pendulum. However, in the last analysis, the methods of karmic adjustment are not really important. What really matters has been clearly indicated by Mabel Collins in her book, The Story of the Year, from which I will now quote. The entire meaning of earthly life consists in the mutual contact between personalities and in efforts of growth. Those things which we call events and circumstances, and which are regarded as the real contents of life, are in reality only the conditions which make these contacts and that growth possible. Perhaps it sounds a bit of a mouthful. But the important thing, she says, in life is the contact between personality and efforts of growth. And all these circumstances in life which we think are important are just there to make possible those contacts between personalities and give us the chance to make effort towards growth. And this is a very sobering thought. It gives us a better, as it were, idea of what life is all about. You may have heard in theosophical literature the use of the word lipika, used by Madame Blavatsky. And these are the great beings who, as it were, are said to adjust karma. But it appears to me, although who am I to say, that they, because of it is a law, because karma is a law, I would think that they exercise only a general control, like the engineers in a powerhouse who watch dials, but only take action if something goes wrong. I think, probably, that our highest levels of consciousness, we actually decide what sort of reaction we will accept for action. But of course then what we accept must be according to the karmic law. In my understanding of karma, I was greatly helped by an illustration given by a former international president of this society, N. Sri Ram. He described the law of action as tossing a ball against a net, which normally returns it with an equal and an opposite reaction. But using one of those scriptures that I spoke about, the Bhagavad Gita, calls skill in action, the ball can be thrown in such a way that its velocity is absorbed by the net without any reaction. And if you like to look at this from a mystical or metaphysical way, you can say this action can be considered as pure, as complete, and karma-less, because it has no reaction. Now, I think we could extend this idea by considering the net to represent the ideal or perfected self of the individual, called in theosophy the monad. Now, I'm trying to put this in words that you can all understand, but I will have to explain a little bit here. And to those of you who are perhaps not familiar with theosophy, I ask you that you try and follow what I say. The monad and it's a Greek word, not Sanskrit. The monad or spirit is considered to be an undetached spark of the pure white light of universal consciousness. God, if you like to look at it that way, which for every individual has a unique note or quality. In man, this light of pure consciousness is veiled and limited as it functions as mind in the lower worlds of consciousness. And you know that the mind is forever changing its point of focus and always identifying itself with external forms or with preconceived ideas. In other words, it is what a psychologist today would call conditioned. Unfortunately, all of us, to a very large extent, function as consciousness through a conditioned mind. Now, this mind selects from its memory banks, the word taken, of course, from a computer, from its memory banks of thought, feeling, appropriate actions and reactions. One can almost say that from this process is born the law of karma, which most certainly governs life at the level of the personality. But let us go back to this concept of the net as the ideal self, the monad, which is the unique, perfect pattern for the individual, that which we will be when we reach the fullness of the stature of the perfect man. Now, action which is not in accord with this perfect or ideal self produces reaction, but pure action in accordance with this perfection produces no reaction. The ball is not returned from the net because it is of the same nature as the net. It becomes one with the net. Again, perhaps a mystical way of putting it, but to think you will see that this could happen in these circumstances. Reaction, then, is the result of our own imperfect action. We can truly say, when we look deeply into this process, that karmic reaction has nothing to do with anybody else or with any circumstances. And this, of course, is a very, very strong statement. But I said we would look deeply into this matter. Reaction has nothing to do with anybody else or with circumstances. Now, take the case of a tethered dog. The dog is tethered to a point, say a pole, by a lead and a halter or collar around its neck. Now, as long as the dog stays within the compass or the circle traced out by that lead or leash, then nothing is going to affect it at all. But if it goes to the perimeter, or if it rushes to the perimeter and tries to go outside the perimeter, then the leash tightens on its collar and it is pulled back forcibly and it is injured. And in a way, this is what I'm trying to explain. Karma, from this point of view, is what a person does, not what is done to a person. We tend to consider the circumstances in which we find ourselves as karma. This is my karma. This is true up to a point, but it's a short-sighted point of view. Circumstances are static and do not truly relate to consciousness, which is ever-moving. That which really matters is our reaction to circumstances, because this is new action governed by the law of karma, and as I said before, by reacting the right way, we can change the future, we can change our lives. From this point of view again, we get nowhere by grumbling or kicking against the traces. And conversely, when we do accept the conditions in which we find ourselves, in a mysterious sort of way, the burden is eased. Again, many of you will know that through your personal experience. As we accept suffering, as we accept conditions that are unfavorable, then we find that they go and the way is opened up for us to live under less stress and less strain. So looking again at this idea of creating our future now, we see that this is caused by reaction to our circumstances. The quality of that future is bettered by effort and by making changes in our habitual way of life. We find ourselves reacting the same way to similar circumstances or situations and making the same mistakes time and time again in this life as we probably have done in previous lives and we will tend to do in future lives. Have you ever yourself known that? Have you ever been forgotten what you did under a similar circumstance and then perhaps you've lost a paper? What did I write about this 2 or 3 years ago? And you're confronted with the same situation again and you write your solution to it again. Then you find the old paper later and compare the two. And the chances are that they will be almost identical because we react the same way to situations time and time again. If our reaction is good or according to the law, it's all right. But if it's not according to the law, then we suffer each time and we do not get free of that suffering. So every effort we make in getting out of the rut of habitual action by reacting in a way more in line with our inherent, latent, or potential perfection releases us from the bondage of the karmic law, the grip of the swing of the pendulum. And the next idea is that the pure white light of our innermost consciousness, our highest selves, continuously exerts a pressure towards a more perfect expression of its archetypal nature. This is the evolutionary drive. It's there because at the level of the highest self of man, there is harmony. And that harmony at that level is all the time trying to express itself through the personality which suffers limitation and confusion. But self-consciousness, the quality of self-consciousness, gives the personality self a feeling of self-importance and separativeness, which distorts the harmony which exists at the higher level, using the word higher in inverted commas, perhaps you could say a deeper level, because of its self-centered action. Man becomes a separate consciousness bound to the objective world of spiritual unreality, physical reality, but spiritual unreality, and conditioned by thought-feeling build-ups over many lives. And man shuffles between the extremes of lazy inaction and a mad rushing around after objectives which are often fleeting in nature and unsubstantial in their true quality. But his true inner nature, his conscience, if you like, is constantly striving to produce balanced action, although this is often unknown to his everyday waking consciousness. And of course, sometimes it's dimly glimpsed. We become aware of that higher faculty in ourselves, which is, as it were, pushing us or urging us towards a different way of action, a better way of action. You can call it conscience, you could call it intuition, because true intuition does work that way. Now, to produce balanced action, we must act not only in tune with the highest aspects of our being, but also in tune with the whole of nature, the whole of the world around us. Because all life is one. Every action affects everything else. Just as a pebble dropped into a pond displaces every drop of water in that pond. Now, if you can imagine a huge rock dropping into the pond, you know that the water is displaced, and you measure the levels afterward, and it's significant. Feet, perhaps, if the pond is small and the rock is big. But the same fact is true for the minutest pebble. When it is dropped into that pond, it pushes all the particles of that water a little bit and moves them. It displaces them. And this is one of the ways in which we can understand this concept of the unity of all life. In the past evolutionary process, the self-conscious qualities of the personality have been built by accentuating a sense of separativeness, and it is not easy for us to reverse this process. The karmic law and its pendulum action is, of course, the binding force from which we must free consciousness. And the law of karma works with delicate accuracy, which we must match by acting in harmony with the law. Just as a juggler uses the law of gravity to perform the spectacular feats which he is able to, he knows that when he throws the club up, the law of gravity, which is consistent, which will not change, will allow that club to go to a certain height and to come back at a certain point. So he uses that law to carry out his juggling feat. To live according to the law, we must cease to cling to the existence which has been our habitual way of life for many lives, and we must strive for change and growth. We must use the law to help us change our way of life and strive for growth. And one of the ways of looking at evolution, at the whole meaning of life, is this question of growth. Our actions should be complete, perfect, and not detrimental to the welfare of anybody else. When there is incomplete action, consciousness is bound by the law of karma, because causes remain until they are adjusted by further action and reaction. At the same level of consciousness, but by different personalities in different successive lives. And according to the law, that which is action, at, shall we say, the physical level, can only be adjusted at the physical level. And we must come back into incarnation and live and experience at that level until such time as all those actions are brought to a sense of balance and equilibrium. Then there's no need for us to come back. We are free of the cycle of births and deaths. Just in conclusion, there's a whole lecture here, which I will do in about 3 minutes, because it's impossible to do anything but just a summary at the end of a lecture, which is really dealing with the law of karma. The moral ingredients of action which can free us from the karmic pendulum are, firstly, loving kindness and a compassion for all that lives. Loving kindness and the compassion for all that lives. Secondly, non-attachment to things of the objective material world. We have to live with them. We have to possess things. We have to use things. But we need not become unduly attached to them. Thirdly, a freedom from personal bias and prejudice. We must act with the choiceless awareness, which is the basis of the philosophy of J. Krishnamurti. And this pure action has been very beautifully described by Marjorie Killian in these words: the only force that can change a karmic imbalance with great speed is love. A love that is a genuine affection towards all expressions of life. A detachment from any desire for personal gratification, pleasure, or return. It is non-judging, non-demanding, self-forgetting, compassionate, and all-inclusive. Perhaps we could say that karma is love, for karma helps us to regain our balance and our harmony. Karmic love is God's love, unconditional. An expression of love in any form becomes karmic love. And I'll close with the same idea expressed in the beautiful little book, Light on the Path. Desire to sow no seed for your own harvesting. Desire to sow only that seed, the fruit of which shall feed the world. And thus, O traveler on the path, thou wilt be treading the holy path of compassion.